Everything is in a state of disruption. Everything is tense. And the point I'm making here, there's no single solution when all these other equations come in. What solves the equation with Iran will not necessarily solve the equation between the Yemenis and Saudi Arabia, who are now seemingly entering an open war between the two. The equation between Iran and Trump will not solve the question of the Hashad and the Iraqi situation. The equation between Iran and Trump will not resolve the situation of Shara in Syria and his relationship with Lebanon that US is trying to turn into some sort of attack on Hezbollah through the neighboring Shi'i villages that lie just on the borders between Lebanon and Syria. And so now everything is interrelated, but also has its separate agendas. I mean, this is a headache. Even a chess player would be thinking, oh my God, how do I put all of that together into a single composite? That's because it's been allowed to go further and further and extend to more and more as Israel tried to take advantages in Lebanon and Syria and elsewhere. And as it tried to get its own advantages, it's pulled Trump into this quagmire of different conflicts, all of which are connected. The Iran one is at the heart of it, but they all have separate agendas. They won't be settled simply by saying, oh, new ceasefire. We're proposing a ceasefire with Iran. That's not going to settle the Yemeni siege for siege war on Saudi Arabia. The Yemenis now, at this moment, because of the moment, have decided that this is the time to kick the Saudis out of the region. I don't know, that doesn't mean they'll succeed in it or whatever, but this just means that the whole thing has become so complicated and will stay complicated.
And how man, you know, given that whole panoply of fires that are burning and independent fuel sources for each one of them, which I argue were, if not all started by the February 28th war that we saw, they certainly got put extra fuel into, but now then they can't, there's not one solution as you just are artfully described here. But then what can be a resolution here? How will these fires burn out? And we'll look separately at the Israel. I don't want to miss that part here because that's a very important component, how that's going to come out. But right now it seems to me that the order that existed even nominally on the 26th of February before this war started off is gone forever. Not just the Iranians going to be in control of the Strait of Hormuz forever, because they said they will under no circumstances ever give that up. But then everything else goes along with that. And what about the United States? Let me ask that specifically here. You've talked about the GCC and the Iranian side. What about America and the Middle East? How is that after this all ends by whatever means?
Well, I think the most important, there are two important things. One is that this war is shredding the standing of the U.S., if you like, military presence. It's, you know, it was sought to be invulnerable. It was sought to be, you know, could not be contested. It could not be attacked. And that has all been proved wrong. And that the American has got its American military structures, have its Achilles heel. They don't have enough defense weapons. They don't have enough wherewithal to launch a major war. And they're not doing very well, even with a localized war, making mistakes. But let me just come to the big question. You know, the price is going to be very high. Because you remember in 79, the question of the hostages. The hostages were held at the embassy, and it brought down Carter and his administration. Well, there aren't any students in an embassy, but there is something called the Fifth Fleet. Where is that? Off Bahrain, I believe. That's quite a big hostage, is it not? It's not really it's not allowed to come out in public expression, but effectively the Fifth Fleet is an Iranian hostage. So, you know, I mean, someone better wise up, I think, in the White House and say, you know, we just have to get out of this, and we have to get out of this quite quickly. Otherwise, this is going to become a complete catastrophe for the United States, for its image, for its presence in the world. It will be a humiliation. So I think that is the only way out. But the problem with us is, as Maggie Haberman, I mean, I don't, you know, I know she doesn't get on very well with Trump and so on, but I mean, as she points out, you know, his psyche is changed in the second round. It is a psyche that is, you know, that he believes he's sort of far more powerful, that he is an imperial leader, and that he can get what he wants and do what he wants, and he doesn't have to care about norms or laws or anything like this. And he admires ruthlessness. He made this comment, I think, about paradoxically about Netanyahu, that, you know, oh yes, there might have been problems with him, but you know, Netanyahu, he's not afraid of war. And obviously that statement appealed deeply to Trump. Well, Trump has got his war. But, you know, wars are not always just like Venezuela. I mean, it won't be, right. It won't be, it's not going to be like that. So, you know, they have to think really hard. And this is the balance that the United States faces, I believe. I'm speaking very frankly, but I think honestly to you, is that on one hand, he has the choice of climbing down from the tree, which psychologically, I admit, is going to be, I don't know if it's possible, but that is one possibility. The other one is to go to all-out war. And I think that that is going to finish the standing of the United States as being considered either as a serious political player or a serious military power, because people will have seen and learned lessons from the Iranian experience of how to deal with the United States. And the first lesson that they've learned is to trust in nothing. Nothing said, nothing written, nothing. It's best not to. That's why the young people on the streets of Iran say, "Why are you negotiating?" You know, he'll say one thing one moment and then he'll pull it back the next moment. So there's no point talking to a person like that. Forget it. We don't need to deal with the United States.
I think you can add another point to that. The other lesson that seems to have been learned is that not only can you not trust anything that our country says, but if you punch us in the face, we can't deal with those blows. We can't stop them. And exactly. As you said, we're more vulnerable than people thought. Now, given that, what then does that mean for Israel? Because that's always been at the heart of all this for many in America anyway, is that, oh, we have to support Israel, whatever. But now then, if what you describe with the United States manifests, and it, you know, the Sixth Fleet headquarters in Bahrain is now can't even go out, we end up, if we spall, especially if we try the all-out war, we're going to fail. We're not going to succeed. And now then, we're not going to be able to protect Israel. So now Israel at the moment is fighting Hamas. They're fighting settlers in the West Bank. Sometimes they're fighting Yemen. Sometimes they're fighting in Syria. Sometimes they're fighting in Lebanon. And then now they potentially could go back to fighting in Iran. Can they fight this seven-front war without America?
No, absolutely not. And they know that. And that's why you had the chief of staff, military chief of staff, went to the cabinet about 2 weeks ago, and he said, I want to flash a red flashing light to you, members of the cabinet. The IDF is on the point of collapse. We don't have people. It's breaking down. Morale is dissipating. And he said, we would need not just one IDF, but seven or eight of the IDFs that exist now to manage what you've set for us, which you started after the 7th of October, when you changed the security doctrine from the Ben-Gurion security doctrine to that of the greater Israel security doctrine, the greater, the permanent security, security at the root, preemptive security against any threat that may rise up. The intent is sufficient for us to have to militarily erase it and destroy it. And he was very tough. And there have been others in former generals like Brick, General Brick. He's now retired, but he's well known. He was someone that, in fact, Netanyahu sought advice from. So he's not an outlier. And he says, if things go on like this, there'll be civil war in Israel. Because, you know, everyone understands. They do. I mean, they can't come to terms with it. But they do understand that everything that had been claimed of the war in Iran, Israel's war in Iran, have failed. There's been no change in the government. They have not defeated the missiles. They have not ended, if you like, enrichment of uranium by the Iranians. None of the things have been achieved. Nothing at all. In fact, the converse. And this is said by Israelis, not me, but Iran has emerged the stronger as a result of this war, not weaker. It's pulled together society. It's brought cohesion to society. That people support the government, they support the Islamic State more than ever. And so, you know, the question is, then what is Israel going to do? And you know, as a military man, I mean, you're spread out across the whole of, well, nearly the whole of Greater Israel. They haven't got some parts of it yet, but they're on that way in Gaza and the West Bank, but beyond that into Syria and so on. What are you going to do? I mean, you can't permanent war forever. Is that going to be what is offered to the Israeli to kill anyone? I mean, this is the reason why, you know, they cannot even come to a solution or support the MOU, because they will never agree to Hezbollah remaining, because it's contrary to their doctrine that came out of the 7th of October, that Israel is always on the threshold of a Holocaust. And, you know, Hezbollah threatens Holocaust to the northern territories. It doesn't threaten Holocaust. It threatens Israel when it attacks Lebanon or invades Lebanon. That is what caused the formation of Hezbollah, was the invasion of Lebanon 20 years ago, long time ago. But they drove out Israel from Lebanon, and the Israelis can't get over it. And so therefore, they regard this as a Holocaust. They regard 7th of October as a Holocaust, which it wasn't. But they do see it in these terms, and they believe in it psychologically. So, I mean, you know, so how are you going to get Israel back on tracks? How are you going to sort of bring it back to Ben-Gurion, who said, we are a small state. We don't have the means for a big army. We can't do all this. We have to stay within the limitations of our borders, and we have to rely on reservists. That's how it is. Get used to it. And of course, you know, Netanyahu has broken that completely and expanded everywhere with all these wars, and now facing off against Turkey in Syria. I mean, you know, yes, it's just inconceivable. It can't continue like this. Yet they cannot see what to do, and this is the dilemma. The Zionist sort of model that has, as amended by Netanyahu and others, has become untenable. The vision has become impossible. So, but they cannot offer an alternative. They don't know. And so Netanyahu is going into elections. The moment the polls show, he'll lose. And this means that he is desperate to find a solution. So he's urging America on. Destroy Iran, to try and revive his message. to the Israeli people that, you know, he saved them from the bomb and that it was his efforts that brought Trump into this war. That's probably the only truth in his statement, but it's not very encouraging for Israelis. So it looks as if he's preparing to refuse to accept defeat in the elections. I mean, the Likud, his party, the other day had this grand meeting, they call it a Supreme Court. It's not, it's just an internal Likud meeting. And in at that meeting, he said and got approval that if there was any security threat at all, he mentioned Iran, any security threat, he was free to cancel elections.
Wow.
And on top of that, he demanded and got that he would nominate every candidate in the if there were elections. Alone, no primaries, no elections. He, Netanyahu, would nominate, I mean, together with Sarah, of course, would nominate whoever would be put up by the Likud in elections. So he's preparing. You'd have two states now moving in this direction, it seems to me. You have Israel on one hand as the sort of pathfinder state, looking at how to manage the whole process. He's already said, well, you know, the real Supreme Court rulings don't apply. We're not going to obey them. And increasingly, you have in the United States, not quite the same because the situation is different, but you also have a president that is saying, well, you know, we're going to have to change the ways votings happen, and we're going to have to make sure that everything, everyone has citizenship, and we're going to have to look at separate states. So we have both of them moving towards this path where they may be trapped into a situation where they will say that they cannot accept the electoral result.
Yeah, that's just going to cause more chaos domestically in both of those countries, which will just add more fuel to the fire of potential civil war.
And which will affect, because don't forget, the Israeli election is in October and the midterms are a month later in November.
Right.
So, I mean, there's going to be an interchange on that. One is going to affect the other, and the other is going to affect Israel. Go on.
I'm sorry. Last question I want to ask on this section here is, let's look outside the region, though, because nothing happens in a vacuum. What would you say would be the ramifications, if there were any significant ones, for China? If all of this situation you just described, where we can't win a war and there's chaos that's reigning there, Iran comes out stronger, Israel weaker, and the Americans maybe even out. What does that do to China?
I think it first of all, it strengthens the BRICS because they can see a weakening America, and that the if America's failed to subordinate Iran and reduce it to a vassal, then it won't succeed with either Russia or China. So those states will take encouragement from Iran winning the war, very much so. And it will increase, of course, China's insistence to try and have a close relationship with Iran to secure their oil supply. I mean, China is only dependent, I think it's 7% on oil from the Middle East, but it's because China is such a big user of oil. It still amounts to a lot of oil. So they are very concerned about the security of their energy supplies. And that's why they'll be very worried about what Trump's doing in Iraq, because China also gets supplies, being closely involved in the Iraqi fields. And if these fields are going to be, if you like, Americanized in some way by this new prime minister that Trump is praising so highly, I think we'll see a China that is deeply suspicious of the United States, deeply sees you know, the whole process of that it is aimed at trying to put China ultimately under a siege by through, you know, squeezing its energy supply routes. Venezuela was just the first. But of course, you know, putting a blockade on Hormuz would be a blockade that could be used against China. Of course, in other areas, we're seeing Chinese shipping is being seized and arrested. And all of this is a siege. Same the opposite way around on Russia's exports. But, I mean, corridors of energy, corridors of, if you like, components for the economy, of supply lines. All of these things, America's trying to seize it and try and be in charge of it, particularly tech. And the rivalry there is becoming bitter as China introduces new AI models, cheaper. And what is more is you don't give up your data to them. You keep them in, you can protect your own data. You can just download them directly from China and start using them tomorrow. And it's going to, I think, revolutionize the AI. And of course, I mean, you know, for some in America, not all, of course, I know there's quite a strong movement that really does not like the Silicon Brothers taking over America either. And so China is moving fast. It sees a great threat to it from America. Not the same threat that Iran is under, but a threat to try and sort of, if you like, undermine its economic growth, undermine its economy in the interests of stimulating the American economy. But it's not going to capitulate either.
You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.